Welcome to The Human Beat. I'm Roger Rocca. Today, we'll hear excerpts from a discussion of how gender shapes our lives. They come from a conversation last month with Jade Aguilar, assistant professor of sociology at Willamette University. Ms. Aguilar teaches courses in the sociology of gender, sexuality, and family. The event was sponsored by the Lower Columbia Diversity Project and Oregon Humanities. Today's program will also include a couple of contemporary songs appropriate to the issues being discussed. Here's Jade Aguilar.
My topic is intentionally broad, and part of that is because I really want to open it up to wherever your own ideas and questions and knowledge about gender already is. I also come from a very sociological perspective, so I look at gender as it actually is in the world. I mean, there's lots of people in women's studies who look at it more from a literature perspective and other areas, but I study people and through scientific methods. And also, as a sociologist, we look at environment a lot. And so if I tend to lean more on the side of how the environment shapes us as gender, that's my lens for which I see the world, and I encourage you to bring other ideas and approaches in. I've been really pushing myself as I move forward in my own knowledge of gender to really take more of the biology into account. What that's meant for me is looking, of course, at how biologically we're shaped by our environment. But the interplay is so strong and so complicated, and there's so much more to find out that anything you all can share with each other and with me would be welcome. So I'll start us out, and if we're heading in good directions, we'll stay that way, and if we want to make a sharp left turn somewhere, we can go there too. Our brains are very much influenced by all of this stuff that we have, and when all your stuff is either pink or blue, you have emotional reactions to those colors, and that starts at such a young age. And so we know that these are not biological differences that are in us, born in us, that girls like pink, but they do love it, like love pink. I mean, little girls now just, and pink is a beautiful color. I mean, I love it too. But when you can see that part of the love for that, and not just like pink as one of many colors that we like, but pink particularly, everything pink, it comes because that's a very comfortable color. I mean, this is this little girl's intimate space and all of her belongings. It's no wonder that she likes that color so much. Technology has made it such that if you go shopping for a toy now on like a Target website or Toys R Us, the first question they ask you is, who are you shopping for, a boy or a girl? And then it directs you into different toys for boys and girls. And I think there was enough pushback now that Toys R Us finally just took that away, although I haven't checked it, so it'd be interesting to look and see if that's gone. But when you already are directing people, and like you say, kids know exactly. I mean, the toy stores look just like that too. So you go in there and you head directly to your section. I mean, there was that little video that went viral that was something to the effect of, some little girl who's darling and 4 or 5 years old, and she's, already talking to the owners of Toys R Us and saying, like, this is wrong. Don't tell me what I want, and so that was kind of going around the internet. For instance, we think about clothing for children. And if you look at clothing for children, the ways that we dress boys and girls has an impact on the amount of activity they engage in, right? So even dresses sometimes can prohibit the kinds of wild jumping and running and flipping and such that boys are encouraged to do, because then the dresses fall, or like especially even in my shoes, for instance, are very gendered right now. There's a little heel. I'm trying to do this whole like they're heels but they're still comfortable thing. But still, I'm not running in these shoes the way that I run in my running shoes. So they are limiting my actions. And so when we dress children, we are giving them either freedom of movement or not. So that would be one thing, for instance, that we treat them, boys and girls, differently, and that impacts their freedom of movement. The research on the way that parents talk to their boy children versus their girl children is very telling in the language of emotion. So yes, boys get told, don't cry, but beyond that, the ways even of if someone is feeling sad or injured, a child, if it's a girl, there's a lot of expressive words used. There's an extended amount of time talking to that child and asking them, tell me how you feel, tell me what you're thinking, share with me. And by the time children are 10 years old, girls tend to have a much larger vocabulary around emotion words than men do. So even if men want to express it, they don't have always the same experiences and practice putting those words into use. And so there's then this image of the stoic man. And I think that the idea of women crying also can backfire. I mean, I had my first interaction with the dean when I was a new professor. It was a bad experience with the class, and my first reaction was to cry. And I'm sitting there in this male dean's office thinking, don't cry, Jade, don't cry. You know, and I'm there like, please do not let those tears well up and start dripping down my face, because it was unprofessional, you know? And yet that was such a natural reaction to me for being like just very, very stressed by what was happening. And yet I could see him thinking, oh, here she goes. Our new young professor is crying. What's new? And so, you know, even though it feels like there was no way I could help it, these are developed responses. Yeah, we see gender segregation playing out by class. I mean, part of what I want to do in this conversation is really, instead of making this all about like men and women and differences, is that realizing there's all these other intersections with race and class and sexuality, all this stuff that like complicates it. So we see increasingly that middle class children are encouraged to have play dates, and that you know they're supervised, and you invite your friend over, and typically your friend is someone of your same age and your same gender. So you start to become insular in the sense that all the people that you play with are of your same age and your same gender from your class. Whereas in poor and working class neighborhoods where play dates aren't as formalized, it's mostly like you go outside and play with the neighborhood kids. And those neighborhood kids are probably of different ages and different genders, and so you have more of a range of children playing together, and so that complicates the way that these kinds of things take place, too. So we're really protecting our children now and telling them, only play with other 10-year-olds of your same gender. Kin work often has fallen to women as to be the, you know, the ones to maintain familial relationships and participate in a lot of the emotional labor, which is kind of a new concept that's really getting fleshed out by sociologists, of thinking about like all the nurturing work and the how was your day, and you know, all that kind of stuff that hasn't been thought about as like work that people are doing, but is a lot of work. There's a great book called The Second Shift, and it's really fascinating because it allows for a little bit more clarity on all of these strategies of resistance and justification that people use to, I'll be more specific, that men often use to not do the second shift, which is a lot of the domestic labor. And so, you know, your example of maybe you also would do it if you were living alone, but she gets to it first. Is that because she's rushing to get it done, or are you intentionally maybe holding back a little and being like, well, if I give it one more day, she might just go ahead and get those ornaments out herself. I mean, I certainly don't know your particular relationship, but it does. There are all of these like general strategies. One of my favorite is the women, you know, the woman was really just wanting her husband to participate more and cook more and clean more. And it was becoming just this real, real point of tension in their relationship. And so they both ideologically came up with this strategy that he was to take care of just the downstairs and she would take care of the upstairs. So in that way, it felt equal because they were dividing the house into two. But the downstairs, of course, was just the basement and the garage, and so there wasn't really anything to do there. But the fact that they could find this moment of equality, even though by other standards it felt very unequal, you know. So like as we're trying to strive for equality and we don't really know what that looks like yet, but we find ways of justifying that to ourselves if it's important. For some people that isn't important, you know, that it's a better source of pride in your femininity to do the housework and to take it on, and that might be the situation.
Oh, I wake up in the morning and I try to get out of bed. It's all I can do to open my eyes and try to lift my head up. Get up, cheer up, it could be worse, you know. My kids could all be starving and my wife be on the dole. And it's hard work, harder than you'd think. Hard to be a man, the stress may drive me to the brink. For I'm fed up, my get up is gone and jogged away. Hard to face another day of working with no pay. Oh, I try to write a book about my new job with no pay, but I hope I have a salary before retirement day comes. It would be fun if only some of the wanted wanted me, a guy with too much talent and a pile of PhDs. And it's hard work, harder than you think. Hard to be a man, the stress may drive me to the brink. For I'm fed up, my get up is gone and jogged away. Hard to face another day of working with no pay. When my wife's at work, I feed the kids, I wash their face and hands. They suck their thumbs, I wipe their bums, I make the dinner plans. To town to buy the groceries with someone else's cash. I used to call it women's work, but that's a pile of trash. And it's hard work, harder than you think. Hard to be a man, the stress may drive me to the brink. For I'm fed up, my get up is gone and jogged away. Hard to face another day of working with no pay. Paycheck and support a family, but she doesn't seem to understand just what it does to me. I feel small, not at all the man I used to be, but at least my kids all have the dad my father couldn't be to me. It's hard work, harder than you think. Hard to be a man, the stress may drive me to the brink. For I'm fed up, my get up is gone and jogged away. Hard to face another day of working with no pay. And it is hard work, harder than you think. Hard to be a man, the stress may drive me to the brink. For I'm fed up, my get up is gone and jogged away. Hard to face another day of working with no pay.
So some of the other ones that I have up here, this is one of my favorite stories, is about a jack-in-a-box where they, you know, they put little babies out there and they put the baby in either pink or blue because, you know, that's our one marker because babies all look the same, or tape a bow to their head or something. And then they show people, you know, the baby opening the jack-in-the-box and it pops out, the baby cries, and then when it's the boy baby, the people, you know, the people who are taking the study, what do they write about? What is that boy doing or feeling when the jack-in-the-box pops out and he cries? He's angry. That's what they write, that he's angry. He's angry that this jack-in-the-box has upset him. But when the baby, the same baby or a different baby, but any baby, is dressed in pink to signify to the control group that this is a girl, then she's scared. You know, so the way that we take our own messages, and the same thing has happened, same baby, different outfit, we read that onto the children, you know? And of course, yeah, we're projecting on that, and then from those recognitions, we can encourage them to behave in different ways, and it just starts this really, like, deep pattern of response based on our assumptions about children. And I think someone had brought up, like, finding out when, you know, at the birth of the, or in the womb, what the child is. Weirdly, one of my friends is now pregnant. She's really opting out of doing that, which is very difficult to not know because they just want to tell you. And part of it is that she doesn't want people to buy her anything prior to. This is just for a little humor. These are products that are on the market right now. There's a website which is great. It's on Pinterest called Pointlessly Gendered Products. And these are just some products that have no reason to be gendered at all. And yet they are, and I picked some egregious ones, but you can imagine that they're, and I'll explain what they are in a second, but there's so many of them. You know, even clothing, like we talked about the clothes from the 70s, you know, it's very clear which is clothing for women and which is men. It doesn't have to be like that. We all have pretty much the same proportions. And so, you know, what we gender these things to really emphasize our differences instead of showing how, you know, we're very similar. So this is a new car. It's only out in Japan right now, but it's a car for women. Kleenex for men, because their noses are so different.
Those are pink.
No, I think it's more of a red. Oh. Yes. The Scotch tape just for girls. Here's some nuts that are specifically formulated for men's health. This one is funny because it's for pets. You know, this is for dogs. For a male dog and a female dog, and then chunky muesli cereal for men. And I'm sure there's some reasoning of, you know, added nutrients or something. But you know, if you go to that website, it's just because people like you all will just go to the store and see something pointlessly gendered, and it's like, okay, we're emphasizing the differences between men and women. And these things become more and more internalized. I mean, and sometimes, of course, then the messages become really powerful because in this case, for instance, we have the same toy set, and you know, except for pink and blue, of course, and then the pictures, it was a girl toy set and the boy toy set, but even there, it's giving us the messages about nursing and doctors, you know, and I know that you all had a conversation at one point about wage gaps, and this is sort of starting out this notion of, well, people choose those careers. And I really want to question the notion of choice, because I feel like the choices we make are often constrained by what our opportunities are or what we even just think is possible, you know? And even if she could have been a doctor, I mean, in some other ways, there's other constraints, right? Because if your added responsibility is the home and caring for children, then a lot of women do say, well, yeah, I'd like to be a doctor, but really, it makes more sense for job flexibility and such to be a nurse. And so, you know, it's like even in that, they're making a choice to be a nurse. But is that really a choice when they have all these extra things? Like, or you could give up sleep. That, some people do that, you know. But so all of these things are very constraining. Did anyone here take an AP exam? It's like a test that you take in high school to get college credit. And so the pictures of the books have a studious student on them, and the two books that you buy, it's like studying for the SAT. You go buy the book and you study at home. So this is for the AP exams. And the two that are, there was a literature one and maybe a history one, and they both have women on the cover. And then there's a math and a science one, and they both have men on the cover. And like, I mean, this is 2013. You'd think like AP exam tests would get that message, but it's constantly barraging us with like, you know, messages about what we should be interested in, and then we often are. You know, I really think about what we like. So much of what we like has been encouraged by us to like it, and doesn't make it less real. I mean, I still really like what I like, and I feel strongly about that, but I also know that, like, in different circumstances, what I would like to do and what I really, like, love, the kinds of books I love to read and the magazines that I get pleasure out of come from an encouragement that those are the right things for me to like.
Well, I was down at the zigzag. That's the zigzag bar in Brooklyn. And everybody was talking at once. And it was getting real. True. But I've been around the block, but I don't care. I'm on a roll, I'm on a wild ride. Cause the moon is full and the gal, baby, I'm at high tide. I've got a beautiful red dress, and you look really good, step in the sands. I've got some beautiful day. I won the lottery. I mean, lots of money. I got so excited, I ran into my place and I said, hey, is anybody home? Nobody answered, but I guess that's not too weird.
since I lived alone. I've got a beautiful red dress, and you look really good standing beside it, girl. I can take you, and if we can, we're gonna fake it. We're gonna save ourselves, We're gonna make it, and if we don't. From time to time. Well, push my button, baby, here I come. Yeah, look out, I'm in a hot time. Beautiful red dress, you look really good standing beside. I've got a little jug of red and real wine, and we could take a little sip. Now, 50 years ago, that was 62 cents. So, with that kind of luck, it'll be the year 3,888 before we make a buck. But hey, girl, we can take it, and if we can, we're gonna fake it, we're gonna save it.
Occupations, which are also gendered, change over time, just like the colors. And as they, as an occupation goes from being male-dominated to female-dominated, the status of that occupation drops, as well as the pay. And sociologists are, by the way, one of those occupations that now have a lot more women in it. And, you know, now as starting professors, I have to say, give a plug for my institution, Willamette pays everybody at all different disciplines the same, but that is rare. And at, for instance, somewhere like Oregon State, you know, the engineering professors will be making much, much more than the sociology professors would be. I definitely agree. There has been much progress. In fact, I think some of the earlier, there were only two majors for women in a lot of cases. It was, you know, like administrative work and maybe some medical assistant stuff, but yeah, that we have certainly come a long way, which is not to say we don't clearly have further to go. Men are also in a tight spot because the workplace demands have gone up and up and up and up, and so it's almost as though if you want to even make a living wage, you or any kind of professional job, you know, 40-hour work weeks aren't really even realistic anymore, and so, you know, it's not as though they're just sitting on their butts, like they're working very hard as well. And so it's like it actually ends up being a system of capitalism that's the problem, and not just this, you know, the fight between the genders. It's not that. And so what we're seeing here is that the women with the highest degrees are actually making 77 cents to the dollar of men's versus, look at this one here, 85 cents for a high school dropout. So that complicates now what our story is. So what this is suggesting is that those women at the top end, those are often the ones who are married to men at the top end who are making a lot of money and have the ability to opt out of the workforce. And, you know, I mean, staying home with your kids is not economically possible for many, many, many people. It's become a middle class privilege. And so in that case, those women, because they've stayed out of the career for the workforce for a while and they're not, you know, they have are not going in the same path, they're ending up making less. There's no setting anything aside, right? Because all of these factors are so intertwined in a ball. So yeah, when you're looking at your family and you're deciding, okay, well, we got these kids and they need some more care than both of us are able to give. And if you've looked at the stats on child care costs lately, I don't have children, so I don't know this firsthand, but new research has just come out that shows, I mean, exorbitant, like, you know, thinking on average $900 per month per child. It's a lot of money. So it almost makes more economic sense to have one of the parents stay home. Okay, so you're deciding who's going to stay home. Well, like you said, men typically make more money, so that makes more sense for them to be the one to stay there. It serves the whole family better that way. Then, as you point out, well, maybe women are more likely to want to be home with their children. And then again, of course, we go back to what is it that we want? Is that how is it that what we want, is that something that we were born wanting? Or is it something we just feel more comfortable because we've been encouraged to want that? And there's a lot of stigma for men who give up their jobs to stay home. You know, when a woman does it, it's like, wow, you know, a great mother. And when a guy does it, it's like, well, what's your deadbeat husband doing? He still doesn't have a job yet? You know, I mean, I think those are changing, those ideas. But a lot of ideas about masculinity come from providing for a family, whereas women don't hold those same ideas about femininity. Being a woman doesn't mean providing for your family. Or it does, but in different ways. So, you know, I think people do make those choices, and it's not to say that they aren't fully aware of it, but there's also all these social factors that shape whose decision it's going to be to do that. I have so much to say about the mommy wars as presented by the media, and because I do think sometimes it is this media-driven catfight that doesn't necessarily need to exist the way that it does, and yet we're trying to pit them against each other. What's better for the children? I mean, how many mothers make the choice? I mean, most people have to work, you know? And so, I mean, some people can choose that, but choice is, again, this loaded word that is filled with constraint. Yeah, I mean, you're raising a lot of good points about a family wage, which did exist and had... I think, you know, we've kind of chased our tail on this one because it's like we got to get rid of the living wage or the family wage because women, when they entered the workforce, of course, they were like, well, you're already under a family wage. So whatever we pay you is just going to be a little bit extra for, you know, some spending money and whatnot. And so that was a real problem. One, because they weren't getting paid equally for their work. And second, a lot of them were the primary breadwinners of their families and that wasn't being recognized. But actually, companies sort of won out on that one because they were like, well, then, fine, we'll pay everybody for their work, but no one's going to get a family wage anymore. And it set up a real situation in which having one of the partners stay home to care for children is virtually impossible.
This has been The Human Beat, heard each month at this same time. I'm Roger Rocca. Thanks for listening.